Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week, we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. Unfortunately, this week, I think our influencer may have gotten lost in the shuffle here. So bear with me. We'll wait a few minutes to see if Shell Holtz of Shell Holtz or Holtz Communication and Technology joins us. But in the meantime, I thought I would tell you that next week, the A-List goes to Paris. So if you want to join us in Gay Paris, we will be trying out new technology from Blog Talk Radio called CinchCast, as well as broadcasting regular shows here on the A-List. So be sure to check out jenniferlindsay.com, my Facebook page, and or Twitter for lineups and showtimes. The idea is to hopefully capture some information from the international elite, as it were, in terms of at least thinking, and get some insight into how things are different overseas as opposed to how we think of them here. Are there pockets of money, for example, that could be funding new kinds of technology, new startups? And, you know, further, you know, what kinds of, you know, influences are really shaping the new technology that is around. So, you know, while we have, you know, sort of a way that things happen in the Valley and, of course, in the U.S. and Silicon Alley, you know, what is it that is really driving forces in other places? Here we have a depressed economy, and there is in many parts of the world, but let's say Australia, where there may be more opportunity to get capital to launch an idea, where there's more risk associated than there is here today. So hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to a mix of both those international leaders that I mentioned, as well as some of the folks that, you know, you just don't get to talk to unless you travel outside the country. So I think it's going to be a great opportunity for us to be able to bring something to Blog Talk Radio that you might not otherwise get. And with me as hopefully get your guide to who's there and kind of what the takeaways are. So it looks like our guest is not able to join us, and I apologize profusely for that. Sometimes that happens with people in high places, get mixed up on calendars, and you don't have enough time to make sure that the connection lasts. So in any event, we will call back in and start the show back up if we're able to get Shell, get in contact with Shell. So far, I haven't had luck today in doing so. But so you get a little bit of a behind the scenes. But I didn't want to miss the opportunity to let everyone know that we will be broadcasting from the web, both live for CinchCast, and I imagine I'll be doing recap, at least one recap show on the 2 days of the conference, which is December 9th and December 10th. So be sure, again, my website as well as Facebook page and Twitter will have various updates, as well as audio files. The CinchCast technology is really exciting, so I'm very excited to be trying that out via iPhone. So in any event, with that, I will let you go, dear listeners. Have a great weekend. If we're able to reschedule the show, I will definitely do so, and apologize that we weren't able to have him on. This is my first time this has happened, so in any event, there's a first for everything. So hopefully he's well, and we'll keep you posted on that. And in the meantime, hope you'll take time to listen in next week. This is probably a good time to make us a favorite or add us as a friend on Blog Talk Radio if you rely on the platform to let you know when shows will be happening, since they will be scheduled mostly next week. In any event, this is Jennifer Lindsay signing off for the weekend. Have a wonderful one, folks. And please listen to our broadcast earlier in the week with Christopher Coppola of Project Accessible Hollywood. It was a great time to chat with him, and I think you'll find that he has a very interesting perspective on things, as well as a lot to share in terms of what he is working on. So please head on over to blogtalkradio.com/JenniferLindsay to access that show. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll hope to hear from here. Hope you'll hear from us next week. Take care. Bye-bye. Hello, Shell, are you with us? Shell, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. I should tell everybody that was listening before that heard me say that I thought we had had a communication error. We have the ultimate communicator on the line, Shell Holtz of Holtz Communication and Technology. We're thrilled to welcome you, Shell. Shell, are you there?
I'm here. Hang on one second.
Okay, it sounds like there's a replay in the background.
I was hearing the show play delayed in the background. So.
Yep. So I'm so glad that you could join us because you are sort of the ultimate communicator in a lot of different ways in that you have survived the different tides or adapted very well to different communication trends. And I thought that having you on the show would be a really great way to sort of blend two of the topics that we talk about a lot, which is, of course, influence, technology, and the intersection of those two things, which is communications. So, you know, how do you think most people know who you are? Because you're very well known, and I asked different people this question before the show.
Well, I think it's a combination of factors resulting from a lot of visibility. I've written 6 books, and I'm on the lecture circuit a lot. I blog and have a reasonably well-known podcast. So between those things, my name gets out there.
Yeah, and I think most people were saying, you know, definitely your books were the way that they probably knew you best. And, you know, certainly you are, you know, a very in-demand speaker. If you go to Holtz.com, you'll see Shell has this schedule that's just crazy in terms of the appearances he makes and is making even throughout the month. What are you asked to speak about the most?
Well, these days it's all social media, which is interesting because I'm often introduced as a social media expert. I always cringe when they say social media guru, when what I am is a communications consultant who's been focused on communicating online and integrating that into your broader, more strategic communications plans and objectives. But these days everything is social media.
And what's sort of the thing you like to talk about the most? Because social media these days is such a broad topic area in terms of, especially even if you break it down just into the communications channels that we talk about, you know, what are some of the things that you like to talk about the most?
Well, I like talking about using social media strategically. I think a lot of people get up and talk about tools and tactics without really talking about how to factor these into your thinking about the kind of results that you're trying to achieve through your communications in general. You know, my focus is corporate and reputation communications, not marketing and product and brand. I also am a firm believer that employees represent the front line of public relations in an organization. Mm-hmm. So I like to talk about how to engage employees in the conversations that your organization is having with stakeholders in the social media space, the fact that blocking employee access is actually counterproductive, that there are huge benefits to be gained as long as your employees know what the rules of the road are and are well-versed in the organization. I've been trying to make the case that there is an increased urgency around business literacy in the organization. I'm constantly shocked to find how little employees know about their company outside of the scope of their own job or their own department. They don't read the annual report, and if they did, they wouldn't understand the P&L. They don't know what other business units do. They don't know what the corporate business strategy is, and it's very difficult for them to go out and talk authoritatively about the organization without that kind of background. And I think that there's always been a case for business literacy with employees, but I think that case is far more urgent these days when employees are having, you know, the same conversations they were having at PTA meetings and family reunions, but they're having them online in venues that are visible to everybody, discoverable on Google.
Absolutely. And we've seen some cases this year where employees have taken things into their own hands and there have been less than stellar results. And what worries me about that is there's probably equally or if not more examples of employees doing good things when given good counsel. So how much of what you hear, because I hear a lot of what you're hearing, that companies don't really see their employees as a community that's built in, that could be leveraged in the sense that they can be your best brand advocates in a way. You know, do you think that how much, and so I guess the question is, you know, when you see the Domino's example, you know, from earlier in the year and there have been some others, do you see that as increasing fear as a prohibitive factor, or do you think it's really about money? Because I think there's, to me, there's this sort of hiding behind ROI factor that can be frustrating because there are some ways to give some numbers to what we do.
Oh, there certainly are, although I'm not a big fan of couching it as ROI. In fact, that's something I blogged about recently, that when you talk mm-hmm. ROI with leadership of the organization, that has a very, very carefully defined meaning to them. It's the accounting definition. It's not a generic term that means here's what we got out of what we invested, which is the way we tend to mm-hmm. define it. So, you know, we walk out of the C-suite having talked about ROI, and the CEO looks at the CFO and says, you see, they're just as clueless in communications about business as we always thought they were. I think we need to talk about achieving results and being able to measure the results of our efforts. As far as the issue with employees are concerned, I don't think ROI or measuring results is a factor as much as worry about productivity, first of all, is the one thing I continually hear. We can't have them out on Facebook. They need to be doing their jobs. But the other, I think, is an expectation that employees are going to say the wrong thing, that we can't really trust them. And I think trust is the real critical issue here. It's not that we don't want to trust our employees. It's not that we think that they're rotten people, but they don't understand the business. They couldn't possibly understand the complexities and the nuances of the business, and we can't trust them to speak well on behalf of the organization. And I think, you know, the Domino's case, I think a lot of people rightly recognize that as an extreme example. I think what's far more common, for example, if you know anything about the world of hospitals, and I've been doing for one reason or another, I've been doing a lot of work with hospitals lately, is the fear that they're going to violate patient privacy inadvertently. Not that they're out there trying to violate patient privacy, and we can't trust them because, you know, they're champing at the bit to violate patient privacy, but they just don't get HIPAA, the federal guideline that requires hospitals to protect patient privacy. And if we leave employees to their own devices in these channels, we're just going to get fined because they're going to screw up and they're going to say something about a patient that they shouldn't. And I think that's the kind of worry that you have in organizations.
And how do you allay those concerns if you can?
Well, I think the first point to be made, and it's one that Paul Levy made very well, he's the CEO of Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital, mm-hmm. specifically around HIPAA. I don't want to focus just on hospitals and patient privacy.
No, I actually work with a nonprofit that protects children, and it's very similar. It's in a healthcare. So HIPAA is part of it and also the protection of children. So I think this is something that is very – it crosses boundaries in terms of importance. So please continue.
Sure. Well, you know, what Paul said in a post that he wrote on his excellent blog, Running a Hospital, was you don't need Facebook to violate patient privacy. That can happen in an elevator. What we need to do is make sure that employees are well educated and understand what the issues are, that they understand what the risks are, that they know their obligations, and have been essentially pre-vetted so that we can now trust them to have these online conversations without putting the institution at risk.
So obviously there's a cost associated with, you know, sort of bringing employees up to speed and making them feel, you know, that they're a part of something that actually, you know, that they're pre-briefed on, et cetera. Do you think that that's perceived as having a higher cost than it actually does?
I don't know that. Yeah, I just haven't heard anybody really talk about the cost of bringing employees up to speed. A couple hospitals I've worked with have talked about incorporating it into the annual required HIPAA training. Others are talking about incorporating it into their ongoing internal communications that's being done anyway, building it into the policies. And, you know, my argument with organizations is policies are worthless if they're not well communicated.
Or enforced.
But, right. Oh, yeah, and I'm a huge believer in public execution. You know, I think that when employees hear that a colleague was terminated because of their third violation of the company's social media policy, that tells people that we're serious. But the flip side of that is the employee who is disciplined or terminated without even knowing that they had done something wrong because either there was no policy, and most companies continue to have no social media policy at all for their employees, which just flabbergasts me.
Yeah, me too.
Or they have a policy that, you know, is documented somewhere but hasn't been communicated.
Right. And it's clear, you know, when I work with organizations, same thing, you know, it's, you know, you hate to mention it, but guys, got to have a policy. And there's, you know, going down the policy road a little bit, because I think it's a really important point to be made. Not a lot of guests make it. So I'm thrilled that you brought it up. How do you feel about some of the quote-unquote open source policies that are out there from nonprofit organizations to for-profit like Cisco that have made their internet postings policy or social media policies public with the anticipate, you know, with the hope that people will obviously use their internal counsel to customize it to their needs. Do you think that really, when I talked to Beth Cantor about this, her sense working in the nonprofit field is that it definitely should be a discussion in an organization that ends up on paper. What's your sort of approach? Do you do that kind of counsel with your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's great that these organizations have shared their policies, and there are a lot of them out there. IBM, the Mayo Clinic. There's a wealth of social media employee policies that are available, and it certainly doesn't hurt as a starting point to see what other organizations have done. I mean, why should you have to reinvent the wheel? Pardon the old hackneyed cliche, but you know somebody's already done a lot of this work. But you know, seeing what other people have done is just a first step to kind of get your mind around what some of the issues are and how some organizations are handling it. You do have to look at this from the perspective of your organization, your culture, your business, the regulations that govern your industry. I think each one ultimately has to be crafted uniquely for your organization. But certainly is nice that you have this archive of policies that other people have developed to get you started.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us, moving to other clients that you may have at the moment, tell us where you're finding kind of pockets of need, given that most of our, you know, as consultants, most of our work is, you know, around sort of certain needs. And obviously I see a few that are around and percolating, you know, especially in the SMB market where they're, for me, you know, they tell me they're not really sure about going down the PR firm formal route. But at the same time, they may need that level of counsel and scalability and prowess in building a social media program that is strategic. Where do you see, you know, kind of your sweet spot right now? Are there a lot of organizations in a particular space that are coming to you?
Well, like I said, I'm hearing from a lot of people if you're talking about verticals within the hospital world. But I do work with a variety of different organizations. I mean, my clients are companies like Pepsi and Symantec and, pretty much a Fortune 500 roster. which has always been my focus because that's my background before I started an independent consultancy back in 96.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what they're looking for, though, the hospital world is different in that healthcare and financial services, not surprisingly, the two most heavily regulated industries out there of size and note, are late to the game. And I think there's a recognition that they are playing catch-up. It's not that, okay, we're ready to dip our toes in and do what the tech industry was doing 5 years ago. It's we're being left behind, and we need to be pretty hasty now in getting our act together. So I think they're trying to figure it out very, very quickly. It intrigues me, and if you're familiar with Ed Bennett's list of hospitals
mm-hmm.
Engaged in social media, it intrigues me how popular Twitter has become. I certainly see value in having one or more Twitter accounts, but the fact that Twitter has overwhelmed the other three channels that Ed tracks, I find very interesting. I don't know if that's just because it's so easy to set up, or if they believe that they can exercise more control over a Twitter account than they can over, say, a Facebook group or Facebook page, but
that seems
it's interesting.
Yeah, it seems to map to something that I hear from doctors, which, so more specifically than just healthcare in general or hospitals, is that doctors that are trying to engage in social media seem to be, are adopting Twitter accounts at a very high rate, if you look specifically at that segment. And when you go even deeper, some of the research that I've seen are quotes from doctors about the ability to just capture very quickly, as opposed to a long email that could go on for pages and pages, but 140 characters can give them a good sense of whether a patient needs to go to the hospital, come see them, whether they can, suggest something, over the counter. And obviously, when I've mentioned this example recently to someone in person, and they were horrified. Oh my God! Can you imagine doctors diagnosing on Twitter?
Well, of course, this is one of the things the hospitals want to avoid, is the doctors diagnosing online at all.
Absolutely. So, I mean, what's your sort of take on the tools that are out there that are, Twitter's clearly gone mainstream, gotten really popular, and, everyday people that do everyday work, some of which are doctors, are starting to adopt those things. What's your kind of take on that?
Well, I think it's great that people are enthusiastic about using some of these tools, but this is, again, where the idea of a policy comes in. I mean, a policy is more than just do's and don'ts. It's here's what we use this for, and here's the approach that we take to the various tools that are out there. So, I get worried when I hear somebody say, we got a Twitter account, and we're not quite sure what we're going to use it for, or, oh, yeah, we're just out there talking to people, unless you're trying to be more organic in your approach. I think this is one of the things that Dell does very well, is have 15 or 20 of their communication staff on Twitter just engaging in conversations with the public about technology in general, not even necessarily Dell. But that leads to the time when you do need to ask somebody a question about Dell and you have the relationship, or when they come out with something that's about Dell, you're willing to listen because you have the relationship. So I think, those organic kinds of accounts are fine, but even then they have to have a sense of, where do we view in this organization the value with Twitter or any other tool, and what do we think is an inappropriate use of the channel.
Absolutely. So, aside from your
By the way, there was a really fascinating case study of a hospital that had just started their Twitter account. Actually, full disclosure, one of my clients, Scott and White, which is a hospital chain in Central Texas, they had developed a social media strategy, but it took the better part of 9 or 10 months to get the legal department to agree to it. And they finally got their stuff up and running, a YouTube channel and a Twitter account and some other stuff, when the shootings at Fort Hood occurred. And they were one of the primary intakes for victims of that shooting.
Oh,
and they
wow.
were able to use those channels in, just a classic case study of crisis communication. I mean, they were using Twitter initially to say that they were monitoring the situation, and then that, yes, they were receiving victims. They notified people that the emergency room was going to be closed to all but Fort Hood victims for the day and directed them to other resources in the community. Then they started soliciting blood donations and even used Twitter to tell people what the wait time was currently to donate blood. And while people were waiting in line to donate blood, they did brief interviews that went up on their YouTube channel about why they were here at Scott and White to donate blood for this cause. And it was just classic use of this stuff. And, of course, they directed their media contacts to these resources, and it became a means for the media to follow what they were doing.
If you go to their website, sw.org, you can see on the right-hand side there's, there's their Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, community, and news blogs. So they clearly make it an integrated part. You know, that those static links are so important so people know where to go to quickly click and get the latest. And I see they have an H1N1 end update as well, which is, everybody's
right.
talking about and everybody's concerned about.
Absolutely.
Curious about, what led you to changing topics a little bit, because I know that there are people out there that want to hear about your latest book. What inspired you to write it?
Tactical transparency.
Yes.
Well, I guess I could come at what inspired me to write it from two different directions. First, I believe that a lot of organizations have continued to maintain a philosophy about disclosure that starts from a position of believing that everything is confidential and then selectively determining what information we're going to make available. And in the environment we live in today, I think the exact opposite is the philosophy that organizations need to embrace, that everything is open and then we will selectively determine what it is that we need to keep confidential. Disclosure, of course, does not mean full disclosure. I mean, transparency does not mean full disclosure. There are things that you can't disclose. I mean, we've been talking hospitals, so
mm-hmm.
let's do that. Patient privacy is something that you can't disclose. You can't talk about a patient's medical situation. But that doesn't mean that a lot of the things that you used to assume that you couldn't disclose are things that shouldn't be, and in fact, maybe are already on the public record out there somewhere. I think most organizations would be shocked if a search was done on the information about them that can be discovered just using Google alone, that they thought was confidential. But the scrutiny that organizations are under is unprecedented. And one of the characteristics of the social media space is the ability for people to organize around an issue with no cost and virtually no time. And if something ends up on their radar screen about your organization, they're going to come together and start digging. The classic example of that would have been the Air Force, Air Force National Guard service for former President Bush, where the document that was presented on 60 Minutes 2 was proven to be a fraud. That was people in the blogosphere. One person said, I'm an expert in typewriters, and I'll look at the fonts on the typewriter to see if they were making that typewriter back then. And somebody else said, I'm an expert on paper. I'll look at the paper and see if that kind of paper was being used in the military and so forth and so on. This is what happens in the online world that was so difficult to do before. And it happens all the time. Hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people ready to mobilize to look into what you're saying or what is alleged that you have done. The best way to not get caught at anything is to disclose it all, right? Is let there be no surprises. And it's a difficult concept for organizations to grasp, but it's one that, I mean, there are many organizations out there that have figured this out and have benefited hugely from it. Thomas Nelson Publisher, for example, leaps to mind, as does Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. So that was one motivation, was to make the point that this is serious, this is a business issue, that it is in your best self-interest to adopt a culture of transparency in your organization and that there are tools to help you do it. From another perspective, it was the opportunity to work with my co-author, John C. Havens. The whole book came about because he was doing a presentation live and I was going to be Skyped in, and for some reason they couldn't get Skype to work on the end that John was on. And I felt real bad. I was sitting there on Skype for an hour waiting to get connected, and they just couldn't make it work. And when I called him to tell him I felt so terrible about this, we started talking more and more, and the book emerged out of that conversation. And it was a great experience working with John, who, in case you don't know, is now the Vice President of Social Media for Porter Novelli.
I know. I just saw that recently, and I thought, wow, that's, you know, there's so few jobs that would take me away from my own consultancy and being able to do this podcast and other things potentially, that's one of those jobs where it seems like it'd be really meaty and you could dig in. There's a lot of room to make some change. Which brings up kind of a curious question for you. Is there a job out there? Because what I find right now is, you know, part of organizations trying to figure it out, right, is this need to have the right people in place. And so I get approached, and I'm sure lots of others do in the social media, or people that specialize in social media or get it or been in communications for a long time online, get approached about roles. And if I see a job description that they clearly don't understand kind of how these things work, why strategy is important, why Twitter is a tool, even if it makes a lot of money for Dell Outlet, those kinds of things, it's very hard to say, oh, yeah, I'm going to sign on or I want to continue through an employment process. That said, are there any organizations that you would either consult for that you wouldn't ordinarily because it would be such a great opportunity or consider going to work for?
Well, in terms of going to work for them, on the corporate side, no. I've been there and done that. I spent a lot of time in the corporate world. I don't know how much you know about my background, but I was director.
Oh yeah, you're a legend, Shel.
Oh. Yeah, I've okay. Well, thanks. I've managed corporate communications for a couple of Fortune 500 companies. I just don't have a huge desire to go back into that kind of a hierarchy. Even in an organization that, you know, is innovative and really understands this. In fact, my friend Christopher Barger, who manages social media for GM, you know, before he went to GM, he was at IBM and very, very successful. And I asked him why he left this sort of dream job with a company that really, really understands all of this to go to a big iron company that clearly is on the, you know, just the starting path. And his answer was, everything's too easy at IBM. there's no challenge.
Oh, wow.
You know, you propose something for social media, and the answer there, oh, what a great idea. Yeah, let's do that. You know, in terms of looking for challenges, I think that would take me into an organization where I would probably be a little frustrated. I have to, you know, make the point that I have been on my own since 1996 with a brief foray into a startup company that didn't work out too well, but that lasted less than a year. And as somebody told me, I had a dinner with a colleague in Toronto a couple of weeks ago. He says, "Wow, you've been feral a long time." And I'm not sure I'd ever heard it put that way before, but it's apt. It works. So I don't know how well I'd fit back in a corporation now, since having been on my own since 1996.
Uh-huh.
I would probably consider an agency or a consulting firm if the stars were aligned and the circumstances were right and the work looked good and of course the money were good and
was flowing.
But ultimately, you know, my key requirement, which may sound very selfish, is that whatever, I'd have to be able to continue to do my podcast.
Yeah, I feel that way too. It's such a good connection with people. And I find for me, it's such a key way to find out new ways that people are thinking about things and incorporate that into, you know, what you're doing to make sure that you're kind of doing the check-in about some of the assumptions that we make. And sort of speaking of that, when you think about, you talked a little bit before about strategy. And I want you to, if you can, define what you mean when you talk about a social media strategy. Because I've walked into lots of situations where there's supposed to have been a strategy in place and gone, what? This is, we don't even know what the, you know, what, I mean, my two things are, you know, audit, you know, competitive audit, you know, what does the landscape look like in terms of verticals, markets, and competitors? And then, you know, beyond that, really behavioral triggers so we can get the community to be on the same page with us. So we're communicating at a level that makes sense. And I mean that in both internal communication as well as external. So the employee element, I think, is extremely important. But what does it mean to you? So I know what it means to me because I have to tell people.
Sure. Well, you know, for me, strategy, and I don't care whether you're talking about social media or any kind of organizational communication, means that it's communication that is designed to support business objectives.
Yep.
And we're talking about business objectives related to a business plan or a business strategy. What is keeping your CEO awake at night? And how can we integrate social media into the mix of channels that we use to tell our story and to influence the stakeholders that we rely on to be able to do business, that's going to help the CEO and the other members of the C-suite sleep better at night. I don't think a social media strategy, by the way, is one that is isolated from the other communications in the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not a new situation. I hear some people talk about this as though it's brand new, but I'm actually thinking of writing a blog post about this, but I remember the very, very early days of the web. This had to be maybe 1996 or 1997. Ragu, the spaghetti sauce company, developed a website, which you could get to at ragu.com, or I thought this was very clever, eat.com. and it was called Mama's Cucina. And there was Mama. Mama was this gray-haired, grandmotherly Sicilian type, and everything on the site was in her voice, right? It was, how come you never call? In fact, the first thing you would see was Mama, every time you refreshed the page, she would be in front of a different room of the house, the kitchen or the dining room or the front door. In front of the front door, she says, how come you only come over when you're hungry, eh? You know, and in front of the kitchen, it was, get your laptop off the table, we're going to eat. And you could learn to speak Italian, and there were recipes that you could just find through a database search by typing in an ingredient that you had in your kitchen. It was very clever and very well done, especially for so early in the web's evolution. The problem I had was that for the time that I spent on that site, the brand was Mama. Her face, that one image, was everywhere, which led me to go to the store to buy spaghetti sauce and look for Mama's face on the shelf, which, of course, wasn't there. They have, a barber pole sticking up out of a canal in Venice or something. The only face I saw on the shelf was Paul Newman's. So clearly what they had done was hired a web marketing company that came up with this completely isolated strategy for a website that had absolutely no relationship to the rest of the brand or the rest of their marketing efforts. And I thought that was a huge mistake. As clever as the site was, there had to be a way to integrate this so that you were reinforcing the brand that was being promoted through all the other channels that the organization was spending money on. And this is what I see with a lot of social media is, you know, we have our advertising and marketing department over here, and they have this $30 million budget, and they're doing all of this traditional stuff. And we're dabbling in social media over here, and these two departments aren't talking to each other, and there's no consistency between what the social media folks are doing and what the rest of the brand people are doing. I think that's suicide, to fragment the brand that way.
Yeah, it definitely helps to have the consistency of voice, for sure.
Right. But it also helps to know what they're planning to do, what they're planning to say on one side, so that on the social side, you're prepared to engage in the conversation about that when it hits, you know, rather than not even know that they're planning on saying that.
So, you know, when you get into organizations where there are tools in play, which it often is the case for me, and I don't know how often this is the case for you, and you have to kind of build a strategy that then factors those into account, whether it's making recommendations to refocus them or change them. How many times do you feel like you're getting into other organizational parts of the organization? Do you make, for example, SEO recommendations because search is so important? How far and wide does your practice go?
Oh, absolutely. It goes into search. And one of the things about being a communications consultant rather than pigeonholing myself as public relations or marketing is all of that stuff applies. Now, when you talk about search, it's interesting that you bring it up because on my podcast yesterday, I reported on exactly that issue. I don't know if you heard, but the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, is now incorporating search into their headline writing, search engine optimization. And the reason that they're doing this is that, you know, despite the fact that they are such a huge media brand, they still find themselves now competing with an ever-growing number of other media properties. And they have come to the conclusion that they need to optimize for search if they're going to be able to compete. And I've been saying for some time that if you're going to work in communications and public relations, in this era, search is not something you turn over to a search agency. Search is a core part of communication skill.
Wow, I say amen to that because, you know, obviously your SEO terms and, you know, how even pages are built with dynamic title tagging is something that should hopefully be all part of the organic brainstorming process, however it works within an organization to make sure that the key messages stay, you know, whether you look at them as key messages or story, are all components that can be mixed up and placed in the right, you know, positions. And search is certainly one of them. You know,
it just intrigues me that, you know, if you read the public relations textbooks and you get into something as granular as headline writing, that they are going to be talking about what's going to attract a reader's attention. And what kind of words should appear in a headline. And the headline writing is dissected and analyzed and written about a lot, but suddenly you raise the issue of search engine optimization. They go, oh, that's a technical thing. Leave that to the SEO.
I know.
It makes
so
no sense
to
me at all.
Yeah, it's a very, very strange thing. And to let those dollars – go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say, one of the intriguing things that I read, this was, I wish I could remember his name, I think it was an e-consultancy write-up on search engine optimization for journalists, although reading it, it's everything he said absolutely applies to communicators as well, was that he lamented that it could mean the death of the pun. because headline writers have used puns forever. And I mentioned on my show yesterday, I remember when I was a newspaper reporter back in the 70s, we had a brilliant sports editor who went on to work for the LA Times, and he's written a few books. His name was Steve Springer, and he was the king of the pun. And I remember one day we had a yacht regatta. I worked in Thousand Oaks, California, and right down the road was Oxnard, which was a coastal community. And they had a yacht regatta, beautiful photos, color photographs of the very colorful sails going by. And this regatta happened to be on Election Day. So Steve's headline over the big color photo on the front page of the sports section was Heavy Boater Turnout.
Yeah. Very good. I wonder if Web 3.0, you know, the semantic web will solve that problem.
I would hope, because I think that the fellow who wrote this piece is right. As a search engine optimization tool, the headline Heavy Boater Turnout would not lead people to your article about a regatta. He used one in his write-up about a British town that had replaced its Christmas tree with some sort of a cone just for health reasons. I can't remember exact details, but the headline on it was Elf and Safety.
You know, there's a lot of good ones in England,
right,
especially.
Yeah, and, you know, again, these are headlines that you could no longer use right now if you're writing an optimized headline. But I found out about all of this on a blog post that referred to the survival of the optimized online. You want to be found, you have to be. So, yeah, it's not a specialist's job. I mean, certainly it is a specialist job when you get down into a lot of the elements of search on a page. But writing optimized copy and headlines, that's got to be a core skill for any communicator.
Absolutely. I wouldn't disagree with you for 2 seconds on that. That's very, very key. I wonder how much another piece that I am kind of a geek about, and since I've been working in online for so long, this is very dear to me, which is analytics. And it never ceases to amaze me when, let's say, a communications organization brings me in and they're not asking for access, real-time access, or getting dashboards sent to them automatically, depending on what the tool is, on analytics. So, you know, when you look at measurement that makes sense for the C-level that you might want to include in reporting, whether it's the reporting we're doing as consultants or that we're passing along that could be included in a report at quarterly or year-end, that's not a piece of it. Is that something that, you know, that has struck you or that you've come across, or is analytics something you kind of stay away from?
Oh, no, I'm huge into any kind of measurement. I'm a measurement geek, kind of.
Katie Payne and me, yay!
Oh, and Katie's a doll. I love Katie to pieces.
She is.
Yeah, and when I do internal communication audits, I work closely with a group called TWI Surveys. Tudor and Ryan Williams are analytics and measurement authorities. I don't know if you've ever heard of Angela Sinicus, who's an internal communications measurement expert. I'm not surprised, though. Frustrated, yes, but surprised, no. That there tends to be in the organizational level so little focus on it, because there really has never been. I mean, the need for measurement is not new to the social media space.
No.
I remember when I one of the first assignments I got when I took a job with one of the global human resources consulting firms. It's the job that led me to move up here to the Bay Area, and I was the Western Region practice leader for communications for this company. And I went out with the head consultant and the head of the office to this large client. And in talking about the project, I said, and of course, we're going to want to measure the effectiveness of all of that. And they said, oh, we're not interested in the measurement. You're just trying to get some extra budget dollars, some extra billable time in there with this measurement nonsense. And these were the communicators in the organization. And my jaw hit the floor. But since then, I've gotten very accustomed to the fact that measurement is not terribly highly valued by a lot of people, which is, I think, one of the reasons that communications is not highly valued in a lot of organizations at the senior level, is because they're not able to convey to the leadership, look, this is how communication helped move the dial, help move the needle in the organization on issues that are important to the organization. It doesn't surprise me that you don't hear people looking for that or rejecting the offer to provide it. But it is a tremendous frustration.
Well, Shell, we are nearly out of time, and I thank you so much for being on the show. I'm sorry about the confusion at the beginning, and I'm glad we were able to capture any time with you. I wish we had gotten to some of the many accolades that you've achieved in your career, and you truly are a communications and technology expert. It's my fault too. It's just one of those things that happens. In fact, I was, you know, getting ready to make a pun myself about, you know, the fact that two communicators can't seem to communicate. And you know, obviously we were able to do that via telephone and get things going. But I think you could be the ultimate communications professional in that you've been able to be very flexible and nimble, and I think that's a great sign of, you know, and a reason, frankly, that the Fortune 500 companies you have on your roster trust you. And I hope we can have you on again if you're working on another book or if you have a conference you're going off to. Will you be at LaWeb next week?
No, I try not to go to too many of the conferences where I'm not speaking. There's way too many of these conferences.
There are. In fact, one of the people that will be guest blogging for me was asking about doing a topic around why does this industry have so many damn conferences? So it seems,
it seems like there's one every single day going on somewhere.
And
I know because Brian Solis and Chris Brogan are up there tweeting about them. So.
Oh, yeah, I know. Better to follow. I will be at Le Web podcasting next week, though. So, you know.
Oh, outstanding. I'll be listening.
Yeah, if you have someone that you want me to go track down. So that'll be a fun thing. But anyway, I thank you, Shell. Let you get on with your day and appreciate your time. And let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And we thank Shell Holtz for being on the program. You can learn more about him at holtz.com and on my blog, jenniferlindsay.com. As I mentioned, we will dedicate next week's series of shows to the Le Web Conference and the international thought leaders in the social space. The conference takes place December 9th and 10th in Paris, and I will be broadcasting the entire week, as well as showcasing some new technologies, blog talk radio called CinchCast. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a fantastic weekend. Don't forget to follow on Twitter, Facebook page, as well as blog talk radio here, and we'll be talking to you from Paris next time. Bye-bye.